Hello, I'm Paul Scott. Today I'm talking to Gavin Lavelle, Chief Executive of Brady PLC. This interview has come about because the company wanted to engage after my critical comments on Stockpedia in my reports of 7th of September and 1st of December 2015. So firstly, thank you for your willingness to discuss things, Gavin, which I respect.
Paul, absolutely my pleasure, and I look forward to giving some answers to yourself and the investors.
Thanks. Okay. And I would suggest that you're wearing a flak jacket, but some of these questions are going to be quite cutting, but hopefully not too bad. So let's really talk about the key issue, which is the profit warning. So your interim results came out on 7th of September, and in my opinion, those results were quite poor, showed a deterioration and a move into losses, pre-tax loss of $389,000. But the outlook statement was still upbeat, despite needing a very large second-half profit to meet full-year expectations. And then a profit warning came on 30th of November, materially below profit warning. So given the sector woes in the energy and commodities sector, why didn't you see this downturn coming?
Well, first and foremost, we operate in the technology space. So we're providing software to energy, metal, and recycling companies. And the way software procurement happens is typically companies hold back their IT spend to the end of the year, and that's typically at the financial year end. If they've had a good year, they'll commit and spend money. If they haven't had a good year, then they may defer investment decisions. Now, in the first half of the year, we don't normally expect to sign a lot of business. It's typically people wait to Q4. In fact, we signed two very significant pieces of business, one with the largest recycling company in the world who are deploying Brady's software around the world to manage their business. This is a multi-billion-dollar business. And secondly, we signed another very significant piece of business with one of the top four commodity companies on the planet for their global metal business. So, in first half, we signed a total of nine contracts in total. So, whilst the overall commodity markets have been under pressure for a number of years, we've, continued to sign some great names, some very good business. What happens then, when the first half concludes, people go away for the summer, we have and still have a good pipeline of prospects for us to signature, and typically people go away. They come back in September, get reorganized. October, November, we have a significant amount of client presentations, and then you roll into contract negotiations in November and December. That's true not just for Brady. That's true for any technology company. I think if you look at IBM or some of the very big tech companies, it's the same. It's the way the business works. So what did happen, actually, in the end of the first half, we have a good pipeline. What did happen was the Chinese market collapsed. I think there's a lot of public discussion about the market in August and September. And off the back of that, we've seen a continued sharp decline in prices for metal, for energy, and in fact scrap and recycling prices have all fallen sharply as there's been Chinese dumping in the marketplace, and that's been hurting some of the weaker suppliers overall. So I think there was an acceleration. You'll have seen a number of profit warnings, I think, come out from the commodities sector, and I think a lot of damage was done in over the summer months and then coming back into September. So it was difficult to see that. In fact, since that outlook we put in the beginning of September, we had a healthy pipeline. We have gone ahead and signed another eight contracts, so we continue to do business. But there are a number, and critically a couple of very significant deals that we've been working on that have just been deferred into 2016. So, we take it very seriously. If we had felt that there was no chance of doing the year in September, we would have said that. We've had significant contracts. We haven't lost anything significant. I just think there's been a deferral in the market overall.
Okay. I mean, given the nature of your business then, that Q4 sounds to be absolutely critical to meeting the full year numbers, would it not be better to put out very conservative forecasts and then sort of under-promise and over-deliver rather than setting yourself, you know, or brokers setting you a very challenging target for the year?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. We obviously set the budget at the beginning of the year, an expectation at the beginning of the year. We did sign significant business coming into 2016. I was really pleased with the, sorry, into 2015. I was really pleased with the quality of the names that we had signed, and we felt that would augur well for the rest of the year. It's just a number of contracts got pushed out, and I think, you know, we've been in a bear market in commodities since, you know, the peak in 2008. You know, markets are down 2/3. We have continued to sell good business throughout that period, and we've continued to show good margin throughout that period. And I do think the last downturn we've seen has been harder and sharper and faster than people anticipated. And I don't think anybody expected that. I mean, we're not in the oil sector per se, but I think a year ago, nobody expected oil to be low $40 a barrel at this point. So I think it's been sharper and harder than people anticipated.
Okay. Looking at your business model then, I was reading through your accounts last night, and you seem to have about approximately half of revenues are recurring, and the other half seem to be sort of lumpy license revenues, which you know, does seem to make the business inherently rather unpredictable in terms of profits. I mean, are you trying to move the business more towards a higher proportion of recurring revenues? And if so, how far do you think that can go?
Well, over the last, I think actually in terms of the revenue model for ourselves, we're about 53% of our revenue is recurring. Another 27 or 30% comes from services. So as we sell contracts, we deploy people to install the software and configure it. So another 25 to 30% is service work. We have very good visibility on that. We're rolling out projects. You know, we have good view on that. The last 20% is the license business. And you know, you're right. It does become binary. If we sign a contract, good. If we don't sign a contract, then that presents, you know, a small risk to our overall profitability. But I've always maintained over the last 6 or 7 years, our recurring revenue has moved up from 30% to 53%, and it continues to move up. And so we do have good visibility coming into the year. And I think critically, we don't have a leveraged balance sheet. And I think a lot of the problems that are getting reported in the press are from, you know, people with commodity assets have very highly leveraged balance sheets. Brady, we have no leverage in the balance sheet. We generate cash. We have cash. And as our recurring revenue increases, this then just puts us in a more and more confident position as we go forward. And I don't think many companies would have more than half their revenues directly contracted, another 30% in services, you know, coming into any one year. So, you know, there's always business to sign. I think that's entirely reasonable. And I've always maintained, just look at the quality of people we're signing with. And, you know, whilst the markets remain challenging, you know, we're not leveraged. We have a good cash generation. Typically, we have focused on margin. I acknowledge this year things slowed down faster than we expected. But, you know, overall, we have a very good business model.
Okay. Just on in terms of the profit warning then, again, I mean, this obviously pollaxed the share price. I mean, it was just around about £1 a share in the summer. We're now at less than half that. One reader asks, queries the timing of the announcement. He said, well, you know, normally announcements put out at 7 a.m., but this one was put out at 5:47 p.m. So there's always a suspicion amongst investors, perhaps we're being paranoid, but feeling that, you know, it's slipping out bad news after everyone's gone home for the evening.
Well, I think if that's been a concern, you know, apologize if that's given any concern to our investors. We had a board meeting in November where it's at that point, as I say, November is the time you start to engage in contracts. We had a couple of very significant transactions that hadn't gone away, but it became clear they would not sign in 2015. We had a board meeting. At that point, it was clear that we were not going to make the forecast in the market. As soon as the board meeting finished, we went to see our advisors. We realized this was material information, and collectively, both our advisors and ourselves agreed that as soon as we have this information, it's our responsibility to put it into the market as soon as possible. I think that is, you know, good governance overall. I think in today's market, you know, we're very open in terms of what we do. We're not trying to bury anything. There's blogs and tweets and, you know, the service you provide, Paul, we're not, you know, no one's trying to obfuscate. It was just a question of as soon as we were aware and the market was aware, we didn't want it leaking out by a third party getting into the market, put it out as soon as possible, and we were absolutely available for, you know, to discuss with our investors. So if that has caused concern, I you know, I apologize if that's the case, but there's been no question on our mind that that was just getting it into the market as soon as people knew about it.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think from my perspective, personally, the as long as the market's shut, I think it's fine to put out trading updates. You know, my nightmare and everyone's nightmare is when an announcement comes out unscheduled in the middle of the day and, you know, people don't have time to react. So that wasn't the case here. So yeah, I'm fairly relaxed about that point. Okay, what should we look at next? Should we go on to just at the cost cutting? I noticed in the announcement you said you were going to reduce overheads by 1.7 million in 2016 versus, which is quite a substantial chunk. I mean, looking at your last full year accounts, looks to be about 10% of overheads. Could you sort of expand on that and what areas you're making the savings, and will it impair the ability of the business to sort of win new business and so on?
Yeah, no, you know, obviously it's disappointing to have to, you know, cut back costs. We do spend a lot of time, you know, looking forward in the marketplace, understanding our client procurement requirements. It's clear that there's been less buying going on in 2015. I think there's still some uncertainty in the market coming into 2016. So we're being prudent by reducing our cost base. We're absolutely focused on, you know, cash and profit generation for our investors and for our customers. You know, we're working with them to say, to ensure them that we have the right level of resourcing to meet their, you know, their current and future needs. So whilst it's disappointing, I think in the context of what's going on overall, this is a prudent step to take. It's going to put us back on a positive footing for profitability, and it's only non-customer, non-revenue facing elements that will have been affected.
Okay, so is it mainly people then, redundancies?
In the software business, you know, 70% of our cost base is people, so inevitably some costs has come out. But we have taken back, you know, we have cut back in areas which are, you know, things like our IT investments or some of our, you know, marketing type things which are non-people related. Whilst the market is looking a little bit cautious, we're trimming back. This is not untypical in the commodities segment overall. What you'll see is, you know, basically people are long inventory. They will dump metal or oil or power into the marketplace. This will clear out some of the weaker players. Next thing you know, there's a shortage of supply from mines or oil rigs or power stations. There's a shortage of supply, and next thing you know, commodities are moving up sharply. So, you know, we need to ensure we have the skills to respond as and when the market picks up, as inevitably it will. I think the super cycle of the world's population going to 10 billion over the next 20 to 30 years and the demand, you know, from the emerging markets, India and China in particular, for the standard of living that we enjoy in the West, that hasn't gone away. There will be continued demand for commodities in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Now, if we move on to the reader's questions, and as I say, some of these are quite cutting, so brace yourself. This one isn't particularly. Just one reader asks about capitalizing of internal costs into intangible assets. Now, I had a look at that, and I think you capitalize about 1.8 million into intangibles, which I presume is development spending.
Yes.
Now, my personal view is that I think EBITDA is a bit of a nonsense number for software companies because it's ignoring a large chunk of costs which are necessary to run the business. I mean, how do you view EBITDA?
Well, from a regulatory requirement, from IFRS, we're obliged to capitalize some elements of new software development. So we do that in line. We run that through our audit department, and I'm absolutely confident that that is the correct way to do it. The IFRS rules were strengthened in recent years, and I think you'll find that between our capitalization and our amortization,
they're roughly the same.
So to be honest with you, I think that is absolutely reasonable. I think if you compare us, we do spend a lot of time comparing ourselves with other software companies, our level of capitalization and the fact that we're breaking even between capitalization and amortization is, I think, very healthy. I think there are many other software companies who have much higher levels of capitalization than we do.
Yeah, fair comment. Okay. And then a reader called Edward asks about your competitive landscape. He's saying sort of how many key clients do you have and is there any concentration risk?
So I think there's two questions there. So the first question is, do we have any client concentration? We have over 400 customers. Mm-hmm. No one customer, and some of these are very large organizations, no one customer is no more than 2% of our revenue. Obviously, we wouldn't like to lose any of them, but if one of them decided to leave the business or they get bought out or taken out, it's no existential risk to our business. I think that's the first point. And the second point, I feel absolutely passionate that in the industry overall, it has been challenging over the last few years in the commodities segment. Of the market leaders in this space, we are the only ones without a highly leveraged balance sheet. Some of our perceived leaders in the space have highly geared balance sheets. Their revenues are dropping, their earnings are dropping, and I think they are in very tough position. And secondly, our overall market share through this period has definitely been increasing. If you look at the total market size and Brady's position in it, whilst the top line revenue has not been terribly exciting this year, our overall share of the market is no doubt improving, and we are increasingly being seen as one of the world leaders in the commodity technology space. And at the end of the day, everybody's going to need food, energy, and metal. And, Brady, we're taking increasing market share with some great names on the books.
Okay. I mean, just picking you up on the first point there, the 2% of revenue point. I mean, given that the profit warning was material and was because a few contracts didn't close by the year end, then presumably the one-off license chunks are more than 2% of revenue, I would take it, are they, the initial license revenues?
Yeah, so the initial license fees are about 20% of revenue overall. And as I say, some of that has slipped. It's been less than we anticipated. As licenses slip, service revenues are also lower than we anticipated. And therefore, we've needed to trim in certain areas on services, just making sure we've got the right resources to deliver in 2016 and beyond.
Okay. And I suppose the license revenues are effectively 100% profit, are they? Is that why they're so material to the bottom line?
Licenses typically, once the customer accepts the software, that's the highest margin for us. It drops straight into P&L. So we try to sell software licenses with minimum of customization, get our customers into production as quickly as we possible. And when customers accept the software, that's when we can recognize the revenue.
Okay. Next question is from Max. He's focusing on the dividends. He's saying that historically the dividends have been relatively small but have been steadily increasing, so there's a good progression there. Do you envisage the dividends being cut, maintained, or increased going forwards?
Well, I think in terms of the dividend being small, we looked at the average for AIM and FTSE last year. It was below 2% or around the 2% level. And Brady, we played slightly higher than the average in the market. So I would counter We pay a small dividend. It was about 2.3% last year. Our policy for the last 6 years, our dividends increased each year. And we always review dividend policy in the spring. We'll see how the year end finishes up. We see how cash collection goes, see what the forecast is like going forward. And, you know, we'll make that decision again in the spring.
Okay. Are you giving the brokers any particular guidance on this, that it's being maintained? Or?
No, because a lot of our business happens in Q4. This is where, you know, we announced three deals in an RNS last week. We are busy signing other business. We're busy collecting, you know, cash, you know, for the year end. And once the dust settles, by the end of January, we'll have visibility on how we close the year out and what the prospect for, you know, first half look like. So I think it's too early to make that call. I think we have a great history in paying progressive dividend. Even since 2008, the dividend has increased, and, you know, we take it very seriously. We appreciate that's important to our customers, but, you know, we will take a view of where we stand with that in spring.
Okay. And, I mean, obviously, because the share price has halved, the dividend yield has doubled. So, I mean, the forecast yield now is quite good at 4.4%, I note, if providing it's maintained, of course. Okay, let's look at the next question. Let's look at institutions. A reader asks about the attitude of the institutional shareholders. I know that I think about 85% of the shares are held by over 3% shareholders, roughly.
Yes.
I know that Kestrel have been buying a lot. They're up to about 20% now, and Investec have been reducing. So what's the sort of overall picture there? Are they supportive or not? Or?
Yeah, no, our institutional investors, you know, clearly were disappointed with the downgrade and are disappointed with the share price performance. That's absolutely understandable. However, in terms of our strategy of, you know, being a leader in the commodity technology space, has great support from our institutional investors. I'm delighted that our main shareholder has been taking this opportunity to buy, and I think that, you know, augurs very well. And I think, you know, AIM does have significant investment in the commodities segment. They have seen the commodity cycle, you know, where you get a drop in prices, production shuts down, you get a shortage and the market bounces back. And, you know, from our side, let's say we're not leveraged. We have a very healthy, balance sheet overall, but with a very high recurring revenues. And, it's just great to see our institutional investors backing us with taking the opportunity to buy.
Okay. And another reader asked about Kestrel, said, have they pushed the board into sort of taking cost-cutting actions or any other strategic changes?
No. I think, you know, we clearly have announced our cost-cutting. We are discussing this with our major, you know, shareholders. We'll see how the year finishes up. We'll be making a trading statement in January and a full roadshow in March. But we welcome feedback from all of our investors, and I'm confident that we're doing the right things to protect, you know, the long-term interest of our shareholders. I would note that the Brady board owned more than 10% of the shares, and I personally bought more shares in September. I think that's an important statistic.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, yeah. Actually, another reader asks, why have the board not personally bought any shares since the profit warning?
Well, the board own over 10% already, and actually I have consistently bought. I've never actively sold, other than one case I had some share options which I had to exercise. I bought again in September, and I think the board have not sold shares. They have stood behind the company, and I think we're invested.
Okay, this is probably the most cutting question of them all, but another reader asks, with currency in management, having run the company for 8 years, the share price is down on when you took over, is it time to give some new blood a chance?
I think it's fair, it's a fair question. I would say you have to look at the context. from 2008 to today, the commodity markets are down about two-thirds in aggregate. So these have not been particularly, you know, if you're not selling as much as you'd like to do, you have to ask, is there, you know, is the market conditions healthy and vibrant? I think you're reading the headlines and a lot of the commodity companies. In this period, we have absolutely transformed Brady from nobody had heard of us when we first got involved. And, you know, I would remind everybody, this year we signed one of the top four commodity companies on the planet to roll out their software globally. We sold the number one recycling company on the planet employing our software globally. We've come a long way, and actually Brady's position and standing in this market has improved massively, whilst companies that were perceived market leaders are, you know, dropping significantly because they're over-geared, over-geared balance sheets, and, you know, we are signing great business with great names. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of that in terms of, you know, market context.
Yeah, no, fair point. Okay, that's it. Well done for weathering that onslaught. I hope it wasn't too bad. We're probably out of time now. I think we've answered all the questions. So any over to you for any sort of closing remarks?
Yeah, I think one thing we should, you know, I think some of your questions referred to, you know, what are we doing to increase in the recurring revenues and, you know, remove reliance on lumpy license sales. One of the really important statistics this year is, to date, 75% of our new contracts have been delivered via the cloud. So we started the cloud program about 3 years ago. Our cloud revenues and our ability to deliver via the cloud is gaining momentum significantly. This means we get a higher recurring revenue. It means we get more of the overall customer's IT spend, whilst at the same time we can do that more effectively and more efficiently for our customers. So I think this is a terrific progress in the business model overall. It will give, you know, financially more recurring revenues. And, you know, we're clearly at the cutting edge of deploying technology, and we will see the benefits of that as we go forward.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for that, Gavin. We'll probably wrap up now. And just if I can conclude by saying thank you for approaching me and being willing to engage. I think it's really good, and I hope more companies will do that, to talk to investors after bad news as well as after good news. So thank you, and well done for that.
Paul, thank you for taking the time.
Righto. Cheers now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye. Paul Scott
has left the conference.
This is Gavin Lavelle.